This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Berman.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on African News Tonight.
In this last year, 10 million more people have fallen into hunger. And if we look at the last 5 years, it's an additional 60 million. So that's showing a considerable trend increase in the number of hungry. And particularly for Africa, it's one of the regions that's most affected.
That's Cindy Holman, a senior economist at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, on a new report showing the number of hungry people around the world rising. Details coming up also. Opposition and pro-democracy groups in Mali say they will continue to protest until the president resigns. And EU foreign ministers discuss the situation in Libya today. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The coronavirus pandemic has caused more than 500,000 deaths in its sweep around the world. What isn't included is the impact on the health of mothers, newborns, young children, and adolescents. Because of the pandemic, health care for women and children has been cut by 20%, and the result is rising death rates and poorer health in these groups. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
It's nighttime in Nairobi, and a pregnant woman is in labor. An ambulance service started by health workers takes her to the hospital. When the government imposed a curfew to contain the coronavirus pandemic, doctors noticed an increase in the death rate of women giving birth alone at home, so they moved into action to save women's lives. Richard Namu is an emergency response operator.
Maternity-related cases has gone higher. On average, we're doing 2 calls per night.
What's happening in Nairobi is happening worldwide, even in rich countries. A UN report shows that health services are being taken away from women, children under the age of 5, and adolescents in order to fight the coronavirus pandemic. The consequences are devastating. Dr. Nicholas Alipui is an expert on child and maternal health who contributed to the study.
Initial estimates are projecting that we're going to see major impact on under 5 mortality rates for newborns, for maternal mortality, the numbers of malnourished children, children who are exposed to abuse and violence, critical loss of access to women's health, etc. So the estimates are quite dire.
The report estimates that nearly 400 million children are going hungry because they're missing meals at schools that are closed. 13 million children are missing vaccinations. Some parents are afraid to take their children to get their shots, and some countries have a shortage of vaccines. Dr. Alipui says if this continues, we could see global outbreaks of preventable disease.
The risk of a new and renewed outbreak of measles, polio, and all these other infectious diseases is actually real, and it's something that we need to be prepared for.
The report also finds that women and girls worldwide are experiencing higher rates of abuse, increased pregnancies, less access to reproductive services, and along with that, more mothers are dying from complications of childbirth. Dr. Alipui says a vaccine, once developed, will end the COVID-19 crisis. But rich countries, he says, will have to help the poorer countries strengthen their health systems, because the pandemic will leave the poor even more destitute than before. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
UN says a report by several of its agencies says the world's hunger problem is getting worse, with Africa one of the hardest hit regions and possibly topping the global list in a decade. The 2020 State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World report that was released today gives us an overview of how the world is progressing towards the 2030 zero hunger goal. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi speaks to the Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, to unpack what the report says for Africa.
Cindy Holman is a senior economist at FAO.
I mean, our report this year has been updated and shows that in this last year, 10 million more people have fallen into hunger. And if we look at the last 5 years, it's an additional 60 million. So that's showing a considerable trend increase in the number of hungry. And particularly for Africa, it's one of the regions that's most affected.
She says globally, about 690 million people are undernourished, and 250 million of those are from Africa. While Asia has the most hungry people, she says there is a likelihood that Africa will top this list by 2030 if current trends continue. She says malnutrition is also an issue.
The other big issue is malnutrition. There's many forms of malnutrition, like child stunting, but also there's issues related to overweight and obesity. In Africa, both of those are problems.
Holman says there is more to hunger than drought and conflict cutting back resources.
When we talk about hunger, it's not just about having enough food. You have to have the right type of food. And one of the big stories of our report this year is about healthy diets. It's not about just having enough maize. You have to have nutritious food.
What's worse, the nutritious food is beyond the reach of many.
That diet is currently unaffordable for 75% of the population in Africa. That's very significant. That's higher than anywhere in the world. It's not affordable. It's the poverty line. If you look at the poverty line in Africa and then the cost of a healthy diet is three times higher than the poverty line.
This means that healthy food is unaffordable by even those earning above the poverty line. She says there is need to pay more attention and encourage the growth and preservation of fruits and other nutritious and healthy foods. In the past, the focus has been filling reserves with maize and other cereals. The COVID-19 pandemic has had its impact, with major loss of income in many countries. Due to high demand, food prices have been going up, immigrants have not been able to move to seek greener pastures, and the infestations of desert locusts in East Africa have had a huge effect on livelihoods and food security. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zanawashi from Harare.
Opposition and pro-democracy groups in Mali have rejected President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's latest conciliatory offer and say they will continue their protest until he resigns. Keita offered over the weekend to dissolve the Constitutional Court and implement some of the recommendations made by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. The regional group last month advanced a number of proposals, including a rerun of the March parliamentary elections and the formation of a government of national unity. Dr. Ramata Sissoko Cisse, president of the Change in Mali movement, told VOA's James Butty that the killing of peaceful protesters by security forces has erased any chance for reconciliation, and now the president must step down.
We are still counting to see if people who are being hurt during the storm on the bus, which is supposed to be a place of worship where they attack peaceful protesters who are just having meetings. We're still waiting for them. So from Friday to Saturday, 2 days. So we had the funeral of about 17 of those people today.
President Keita, I think he made some, concessions on Saturday evening by agreeing to withdraw the appointments he made to the Constitutional Court. Why can't the opposition accept that?
Because that's not our request. We requested him to resign because from the first day, the person that he's trying to dismiss from the Constitutional Court was the one who declared him winner of the election that everybody knew he didn't win. So to dismiss that person for us is just a political move to save himself when we know that he is the problem. We're not targeting president of the constitutional court. We are targeting him because we believe he has been elected during a fraudulent election, and we want to make sure that he understands that he needs to step down.
Now, where do you think things are going? Because some people were even suggesting that this crisis is heading towards a possible civil war. That's ominous because Mali is already being destabilized by Islamist insurgents.
Yes, we believe that the fact that he has been here for 7 years with a government who was incapable to satisfy the need of the population, that alone was sufficient for him to resign. Now that he went over to even give an order to shoot on peaceful demonstrator, that's even one more reason why we believe that there is no room for negotiation at this point. It is the people of Mali who are demanding his resignation. Over 90% of people do not believe in this government, never believed in it. And today, they're more resilient than ever. So to save lives, he just need to accept that he is not recognized by the majority of Malian, and he needs to just make a decision, a wise decision, to resign and let the people of Mali decide for the future of Mali.
So, Dr. Cisse, as the crisis in Mali enter another week, is there a possible compromise that people can look at least from the opposition side?
The only compromise right now is what happens to him after he resigns. He arbitrarily arrested and kidnapped many opposition leaders and civil society members. And we believe that this is just the violation of human rights that cannot be tolerated. Remember, Mali is a very old country. We had a constitution since the 13th century. So we are an old country. We know human rights, constitution, law and order. We are used to it. We're not used to violence. And the fact that he just stormed in a place of worship and killed people, we are not ready to compromise. So we believe that at this point, it is too late. We are into this until he resigns. There's no way we're going to be compromising anything.
That was Dr. Ramata Sissoko Cisse, president of the Change in Mali movement, speaking with VOA's James Buddy. The South African government has reintroduced a ban on alcohol sales and a nighttime curfew in response to a big increase in COVID-19 infections and deaths. There have been at least 280,000 confirmed cases in the country so far, with more than 4,000 deaths. But opposition parties say the government's latest actions are to cover up its failure to build enough treatment and testing capacity. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
President Cyril Ramaphosa says COVID-19 is indeed a disease that's caused by a virus, but that it's spread by human conduct. His administration allowed alcohol sales to resume a few weeks ago after a 100-day hard lockdown during which that was prohibited. But Ramaphosa says many South Africans' bad drinking habits have worsened the pandemic's impact.
There is now clear evidence that the resumption of alcohol sales has resulted in substantial pressure being put on hospitals, including trauma and ICU units, due to motor vehicle accidents, violence, as well as related trauma that are alcohol-induced.
The CEO of the Beer Association of South Africa, Patricia Pillay, says the renewed ban is going to destroy people who rely on the alcohol industry for their livelihoods. She says the previous embargo cost more than 100,000 jobs.
A lot of small businesses had actually shut down, and we have over 35,000 township businesses that are going to be bankrupt. So besides this, this industry will just move into the illicit economy, and that's very concerning to us.
While there's truth in what Pillay says, it's also true, according to people in the healthcare sector, that the previous ban on alcohol saw a big decrease in hospital admissions. Pillay says the industry understands that.
That is why we have been appealing to the public to say, look, you need to drink responsibly. And we've been asking for drinking in moderation. But
many in healthcare say these appeals have largely failed, judging from all the alcohol-related casualties they've had to deal with since the booze ban was lifted.
Trauma took a big dive during lockdown. Our cases went down by 70%, mainly because there was much less in the way of alcohol.
This doctor works at a major Johannesburg hospital. He says as soon as people began drinking again, his facility was swamped.
We're seeing up to 60% of all car crash victims and up to 80% of all interpersonal violence victims being over the legal limit. Alcohol has placed a huge, huge load onto the units at the very time when we can least afford it.
His stance and the government's position is that the beds are needed for people who are seriously ill with COVID-19. The doctor adds that his hospital can't afford to use him and its nurses to treat patients admitted because of, say, a car accident because of alcohol.
Most of them have had to be deployed to look after the COVID load. As a result, if you have a crash, the chances are that the nursing staff will be at full stretch. And that's a huge problem for us, and we are absolutely full.
Opposition parties maintain there'd be no need to ban alcohol if the government had fulfilled its promise of using the long lockdown to build and equip field hospitals. Instead, only one of nine provinces has fully functional field facilities, and that's the Western Cape, which is run by an opposition party. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As EU foreign ministers discussed the situation in Libya today, Turkish foreign minister said no Libya ceasefire until the Libyan National Army pulls out of both Sirte and Al-Jufra. The UN-backed Government of National Accord showed photos of LNA reinforcements around Sirte, and Russian and Egyptian insist that both cities are a red line not to be crossed. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Wolfgang Poshtai, security and policy analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations.
Turkish national interests are best served if the GNA and Operation Volcano get the whole of Libya under control. The Misrata and the Islamist groups supporting the GNA want to attack Sirte and the East anyway to crush the LNA, to eliminate it once and for all, to take revenge for the previous defeats in Benghazi and Derna, and to allow for the return of refugees to those cities. Obviously, both also want to get unlimited access to the vast economic resources in the oil crescent and further on in the East. On the other side, there is no indication whatsoever that the LNA is willing to withdraw from Sirte and Al-Jufra. From a military position, it would be next to impossible for them to defend the oil crescent thereafter, after they have left Sirte and Al-Jufra or lost Sirte and Al-Jufra. The LNA fully relies on that Egypt would intervene if Operation Volcano attacks Sirte. So for the time being, as there is no credible outside pressure to force both sides to accept a ceasefire, prospects are dire. A lasting ceasefire is only realistic if both sides realize that they have no viable military option to successfully attack the other. This could be soon, if Turkey and the Islamists realize that the Egyptian threat to intervene is credible, or after such an offensive is stopped by the Egyptians.
Both the UN Secretary General and German Foreign Minister suggested a buffer zone in Sirte and Al-Jufra to pave the way for a ceasefire, followed by resumption of talks for a political solution. What are chances of success for this proposal, especially that the UN Security Council unanimously called for halting all hostilities and conflicts around the world?
I would say this UN Security Council resolution about the so-called global ceasefire would give both sides the chance to accept a ceasefire in a face-saving way. Currently, there is a discussion in the background about a distribution of the oil revenues under international supervision. If there is a success, this would be very helpful, but the GNA and the Central Bank of Libya are blocking. Understandably, they want to retain full control over the oil revenues. If there is a ceasefire, the prospects for maintaining it are much more better if there is a credible military interpositioning force. If this is not the case, a renewed outbreak of hostilities, at least on a low level, is quite likely. The European Union, under the lead of Germany right now, would be able to send one of their rapid reaction so-called EU battle groups. Currently, one of those battle groups is German-led, the other one Italian-led. So I would recommend to the Europeans to find a consensus within the European Union about this, to launch some background discussions with the international stakeholders, especially Turkey, Egypt, and the Emirates, and of course also the Russians, and to come forward with a concrete proposal for securing a ceasefire at the right time when the chances, the prospects for such a ceasefire are quite good.
The European Union foreign ministers are discussing the situation in Libya today, and the Speaker of the Libyan Parliament, Aqila Saleh, is touring Europe seeking European backing of the Cairo Declaration. What are the potential scenarios in Libya?
Actually, I see four possible scenarios. The first one is a sustained stalemate as we have it right now, with low-level fighting on and off. The second one is a major operational volcano offensive on Sirtan and Al-Jufra with two possible outcomes. One would be it would end in a certain defeat if Egypt intervenes in full force. Or if Egypt keeps out, this would be a decisive victory and the collapse of the LNA at the very end. The third option would be a ceasefire without international supervision and a resumption of hostilities soon thereafter. The fourth one, a ceasefire with an international peace force enforcing a buffer zone, and this would bring a real chance for a political solution. Such a solution could be some kind of a new federalist system in Libya. This could be based on the modified 1951 Libyan constitution, which was a quite modern constitution, with some elements of the 63 amendments, and most important, a formula about the distribution of the oil revenues between the three historic provinces.
That was Wolfgang Poshtai, security and policy analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The managing director of the Gambia's National Water and Electricity Company has been fired shortly after signing a World Bank $225 million fund earmarked to ease the country's energy crisis. This followed frequent electricity cuts and acute water shortages in the greater Banjul area. Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Speaking at the announcement of the World Bank Development Fund, Alpha Robinson had expressed confidence that Gambia's energy problems would soon be a thing of the past. Soon after, so was he.
But it is important for people to remember that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And the tunnel I'm looking through is no longer a long tunnel. And I believe we will get there. Thank you very much.
Robinson has been replaced by his deputy, Nani Juara. A government statement said Robinson has been redeployed to an unspecified foreign service position. Robinson's removal followed infighting in the management of the government-owned water and electricity company. He was accused of corruption, awarding crude oil supply and lubricant contracts to a friend, and lack of cordial relationship with his management team. Robinson has denied the allegations. His supporters wrote a social media op-ed days before his removal, in which they alleged that Robinson was a victim of blackmail and lies they told to President Adama Barrow. They claim some alleged corrupt NAVIC officials have conspired to remove him so that they could steal the World Bank funds. Pas Sambajau is a Gambian political analyst.
I am not surprised by it because there have been a lot of complaints by consumers about lack of electricity. But I think the bigger picture is how viable is NAVEC, because I think we all know that since its inception, Gambians have been having a problem with that. So I'm thinking that we have a serious problem with that institution. And Alpha Robinson, I think, would be almost the 10th MD who has been removed, and the problem continues to persist in that country.
Joe says replacing the old NAVEC managing director might not end the company's problems. He says its work culture must change.
We have a deep-rooted culture of maladministration in that country. And I think anybody who comes, especially an outsider, and wants to reform, would face stiff competition. So you have to be a very strong person. But that would only work, though, if you have a government that has the political will to at least give you the backing to be able to make the necessary reforms that are needed in that country.
The Gambia has been struggling with frequent power cuts and acute water shortages. Some people have had to dig boreholes at their homes to produce their own water. For VOA Africa, this is Pandiri by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbi Abaro, thanks for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.